they originate. And so they are accelerated as supernova remnants mainly, and then they start traveling through interstellar space. As they travel to interstellar space, they interact with the interstellar medium, the gas and the radiation fields. So these processes are quite complicated and difficult to describe. And if you want to predict the spectrum that the cosmic ray have when they reach us, when they reach Earth, you also have to take into account solar modulation as these cosmic rays penetrate the heliosphere. So I'm going to actually not talk too much about propagation today, and I will go back to some of the main concepts tomorrow, and specifically when I talk about experimental results, and especially related to dark matter searches and what part of the propagation is more relevant to those searches. So as I said before, as the cosmic rays propagate to the galaxy, they interact with the interstellar medium, and they experience energy losses because of these interactions, and the charged particle also get deflected in the galactic magnetic field, so their trajectory changes directions. And what we observed at Earth when we look at cosmic rays is that they're, to a large degree, they're isotropically distributed. So how well do we understand the propagation? So we can actually infer a lot of information on cosmic ray, on the processes really that regulate propagation by looking at the, in particular by looking at secondary nuclei. So the secondary nuclei, again, are sort of the nuclei or the particles that are actually that are generated by primary cosmic rays as they interact with the interstellar medium. Also look at, which is also mainly antiparticles we believe come from, but also looking at gamma rays and synchrotron radiation. So the fact that the cosmic rays are isotropically distributed, it's already telling us that the that cosmic rays don't travel through straight line towards us, right? The trajectories get modified. Also, the abundance of secondary cosmic rays, like boron and beryllium and others, tell us, it's another piece of evidence that points to the fact that the cosmic rays travel diffusively. And in these processes, the galactic magnetic fields obviously have are crucial. So let's look a little bit more into detail on how the secondary production affects our knowledge of cosmic ray propagation. So we can measure the boron to carbon ratio, and this is the measurement that comes from a number of experiments. So this is the boron to carbon ratio as a function of the kinetic energy. In particular, we have recently got a beautiful measurement of this ratio from the AMS detector. So the boron to carbon ratio, it's measured, and it determines the grammage, X. The grammage is related to the amount of material that the cosmic ray goes through as it travels to us. And it's also related to the escape time. So this is the expression for the grammage, where you have density. This is the mean, N is the mean gas density, mu is the mean gas map, and V is the velocity of the particle. So essentially the grammage is a density multiplied by a thickness that the cosmic rays go through. And that affects the grammage, is going to affect the rate of interaction of the primary cosmic rays, and therefore determine the number of, or the rate at which secondary cosmic rays are produced.
Is it analog of reporting atmospheric depth in
Yes, it's the same concept. It's essentially the same concept. So it's a quantity that also depends on energy. So through the measurement of the boron to carbon ratio at a 10 GeV, and actually the grammage dependence on energy is parametrized really as more precisely as a dependence on rigidity, where again the rigidity is the, well, I'll say it in the next slide, is the momentum divided by the charge of a particle. So for a 10 GeV nucleon, it's 10 grams per centimeter squared. So if you consider, if you calculate the grammage by assuming some density of material in space and the size of the galaxy, you can actually, by the measure grammage, you can calculate the escape times for cosmic rays. And that gives you escape times of the order of hundreds of millions of years. So cosmic rays live that long in our galaxy before they can escape into interstellar space. And this is much larger than what you will get by assuming that cosmic rays are produced at some source and they travel with some fraction of the speed of light, say 30%. You know, we're talking about very relativistic particles, and they just travel straight outside of the galaxy, and you give some size to the galaxy, and they will be confined just for tens of thousands of years at most. So the fact that the measurement of this secondary nuclei production gives us a determination of the grammage is telling us that cosmic rays are propagating through the galaxy diffusively. The boron to carbon ratio also has a dependency on energy. So that tells you that the grammage is decreasing also as a function of the energy, or more precisely as a function of the rigidity. And the dependence on the rigidity is of the order of 0.3 to 0.6. You can actually have some determination of that power law spectrum. So when we measure the spectrum of the cosmic ray at Earth, that's going to be a combination of the injection spectrums that the cosmic rays had when they were accelerated, plus the country or the effect of this diffusive propagation through the galaxy. So then the flux of cosmic rays that I measured at some point in the galaxy now is going to have a power law spectrum where the slope of the spectrum is determined by the injection spectrum and the effect of propagation. And so this tells you that the spectrum that we observe at Earth is going to be steeper, so it's going to fall off faster than what it's actually produced at the source. Okay, so that is sort of what we'll see. So say for protons, the spectrum that we observe at Earth has a slope of about 2.7. We've seen that when we look at the supernova remnant to gamma rays, the indices for the gamma rays at those sources are about around 2.3. Diffusive shock acceleration predicts an index of 2. So we are pretty close to the right answer. So that was an oversimplification on how to deal with the propagation. If you want to do things more in detail, you actually have to solve the diffusion equation. It has, so that this equation gives you the density of cosmic rays, both in space, in momentum, and at some time. And it depends by a number of factors. It depends on the source terms. These are the sources that are accelerated, the cosmic rays, and these terms also includes spallation processes and decay, plus the diffusion terms that, or the diffusion processes that I have discussed very generally before. But then there are other processes like reacceleration, convection, radioactive decay, and fragmentation that also need to be accounted for. Solving this equation is pretty complicated, and usually people make approximations. So essentially, you assume that in a galaxy like the Milky Way, cosmic rays basically diffuse in a box. And this is the size of the box that is generally used. So this is the disk of the galaxy. You see here the stellar bulge. So the sources of cosmic rays, so the sources where cosmic rays are accelerated, are confined in this model to a thin slice that goes to the disk of the galaxy that has a height of roughly 100 parsecs. The cosmic rays that are accelerated are then allowed to diffuse through a halo region that has a height of 5 to 10 kiloparsecs. And then there are some boundary conditions to the box, and the cosmic rays at some rate are allowed to escape according to what conditions you set. These things are not things like, for instance, the halo heights are not very well known. So in other words, we don't know very well what is the confinement volume a cosmic rays in the galaxy. And we can get some determination of the rough size, even say by measurement of the cosmic rays, but you get a determination of roughly in this ballpark. So this is a leaky box approximation. Also, usually solving this equation, I mean, when people solve this equation, they assume a steady state, so that the density of the cosmic rays in the galaxy is constant over time. And so that assumption, it's broken if you want to, say, for instance, consider the effect of a nearby source, or you look at the stochastic effects of the distribution of sources in the galaxy. So in that case, this doesn't give you a good answer. And we'll see when we look at the measurements of cosmic rays coming from, say, AMS and other experiments, that this sort of solving this sort of equation doesn't give you a good prediction for the measured spectra, in particular for the positron. But then if you assume a nearby source, then you get much better agreement with the data. And yes?
What is the physics of the reacceleration?
I probably shouldn't explain that. It's basically telling you that cosmic ray particles not only lose energy as they propagate, they can actually get reaccelerated. So, but it's a complicated process. And okay, so then there are things like terms that we can. There is inputs into this equation that are actually coming from cosmic ray data at all. That are coming from the data cosmic ray data itself, like the, for instance, the boron to carbon ratio. And so you can get information like the Grammage dependence on the rigidity, and you can get also the diffusion equation terms that goes in here. So this is overall a very complex picture. We know a lot on how these processes work, but there are still many uncertainties that plague our understanding and of the cosmic reproduction and propagation. And this, obviously, depending on how you're looking for dark matter through indirect detections, turn into large systematic uncertainties in your searches. So as I said before, I'll get back to some of these issues when I am going to discuss dark matter searches. So, but what I want to discuss now is dark matter and give a brief overview of the observational evidence that we have. I don't know how much of this you have seen so far, but I'll try to go very briefly because you might have seen some of this already last week. But let me know. Feel free to stop me if I have if you have questions. So evidence for dark matter comes from very different scales, from the observation of the kinematics of the stars and galaxies and in clusters of galaxies, but also looking at the universe as a whole and looking at things like the CMB. So first, the existence of dark matter was postulated by Zwicky in the 1930s to explain the dynamic of the galaxy in the coma clusters. Clusters of galaxies are the largest gravitationally bound system known in the universe. And depending on the cluster, they have a number of galaxies. The number of galaxies in the cluster ranges from tens of galaxies to large clusters that have thousands of galaxies. So Zwicky could actually calculate the total mass of the clusters by just basically looking or measuring the velocities of the galaxies. So if you assume that the cluster is in dynamical equilibrium, meaning that it's not there isn't an ongoing expansion or collapse, and it is fully held together by gravity, then you can use the virial theorem to relate the gravitational potential energy of the cluster to its kinetic energy. So you can say you have a galaxy at some distance r from the center of the cluster, and its gravitational potential energy is determined by the mass that is enclosed by that radius and at the distance of the galaxy from the center of the cluster. Then you need to measure the kinetic energy, and that measurement of the kinetic energy is one half the mass of the galaxy, and then this, the velocity is actually a velocity dispersion here. If you are measuring the velocity of a galaxy in a galaxy cluster, you're basically looking at the Doppler shift of the spectral line of that galaxy. So you don't have, you only can measure the velocity along the line of sight from you to that galaxy. And that you actually don't really measure a velocity dispersion, you measure the velocity that the galaxy has, but you have to take into account that the galaxy itself has some velocity. So what you put in here is the velocity dispersion that you measure for the galaxies in the cluster compared to the velocity of the cluster as a whole. And assuming spherical, since you're measuring the velocity only in one dimension, you assume spherical symmetry in the cluster, so you just basically, you just multiply that number by 3. So by doing this calculation for the comma cluster, Zwicky got that the, when looking at how many galaxies he, for all the galaxies that they could observe in that cluster, that the mass or that the actual galaxy had to do, to be a lot more massive than expected. So the luminous mass of the cluster, meaning the galaxies that he was observing, was far smaller than the mass that he was observing.
How did he get the total mass?
He got the total mass by, oh, right, the fact that the, basically the bottom line is that the galaxies were going too fast to stay gravitationally bound to the cluster. So he could determine the total mass of the cluster just by looking at counting the galaxies, but the velocity determination of the galaxy told him if there was that much, only the mass that I'm seeing, with that velocity, they would not stay bound. They would just fly away.
How far off was the...
So this is the term where the dark matter comes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It comes into.
How far off?
I think about roughly an order of magnitude to 2. And actually, in that case, he was not observing galaxy cluster, and not the mass of the galaxy cluster is dominated by dark matter. The second heaviest, more massive component comes from gas, right? Not from galaxy. But and that, so there is like 10 times more gas than there are galaxies, but there is 10 times more dark matter than there is gas. So it was a big discrepancy, but not fully explained by gas. Okay, so yes. Right. So you could have, in principle, right, but then that would mess up your determination of the mass.
Yes.
Because if I have, yes, if you...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like,
yes, but right, if those galaxies happen to be just passing nearby and not gravitationally bound, and then you observe them a long time later and they are no longer there, right, the mass might result a lot smaller. Right, but in this system are... there are good reason to believe that they are actually in equilibrium. It's long since they form, and it's going to be a long time since anything happens to them. So it's a reasonable assumption to make.
How you measure the luminous mass?
So that is just looking at the brightness of the objects, and I'm not sure exactly how they did it back then.
Mass and luminosity in galaxies. So from there, he inferred the mass.
Yeah. Okay. So that is looking at big system like clusters of galaxies, but we still see deviation from prediction from Newtonian gravity looking at smaller systems like galaxies. And that was observed in the 70s and probably even a little earlier than that. Then if you look at the rotation curve of a galaxy, so as the rotation curve of a galaxy as the distance, as a function of the distance from the center of the galaxy, you have some expectations that come from Newtonian gravity, but the observation can be quite different from what you expect. So let's look at this a little bit more closely. So let's take the Andromeda galaxy as an example. So Again, here you want to measure the rotation curves of the galaxy, and then you can look at the stars and you can look at the gas. And the gas is a particularly good thing to look at because it extends farther from the center of the galaxy than the stars do. And so it can probe the mass distribution at farther away distances than the star can. And the way you observe, you measure the velocity of the gas is to look at the 21 centimeter line, which is emitted by a neutral hydron, which is basically the transition from two different spin states of the atomic hydrogen. And this transition is very rare, but there is a lot of hydrogen in the galaxy, so this signal is pretty bright. So if you look at the velocity dispersion, if you look at the line of sight velocity of the gas, say in the Andromeda galaxy, so this is the H1 distribution or the atomic gas distribution in the Andromeda galaxy, and you measure the velocities as a function of the distance from the center of the Andromeda galaxy, you see that there is a part of Andromeda that is moving away from us, and there is a part of the Andromeda galaxy, so there is basically circular motion around the galaxy. And here the velocity is centered, so at the center of the galaxy, there is some non-zero velocity, obviously, and that is systemic velocity of the Andromeda galaxy because that system is also moving as a whole. So we are looking at the rotational curve, taking into account that the galaxy is also moving. So then we plot the velocity, so the rotational velocity that we get from the gas as a function of the distance from the center of the galaxy. These are the points that we get from Andromeda, and these are rotational velocity for other galaxies. In particular here, it's NGC 2403. And this is the prediction that one would get, and let me show it for Andromeda too, by just looking at the luminous matter in those galaxies. In Andromeda, this is the contribution from the gas, this is the contribution from the stellar bulge, and this is the contribution from the stellar disk. You can see for Andromeda, there's a bit better agreement, but there is as you go to farther distances, there is a big discrepancy. And it's not just a simple question of rescaling what the Newtonian gravity tells you that the velocity distribution or the rotational velocity should be like, because even if I rescale this here, there is still a discrepancy in the outskirts of the galaxy. So this is just pretty trivial, but if you look at, just consider Newtonian dynamics, then this is the centripetal velocity, so that you see that the velocity, the rotation velocity, if you only consider Newtonian dynamics, scale is 1/√ of the distance from the center of the galaxy, right? This behavior, but that's not what we observe. Then you can say, well, there is the mass distribution is not really what I'm seeing through the stars and the gas, but it actually scales as r, and so the density scales as 1/r². So meaning that there is some additional mass that is not falling steeply like the stars. And the gas density, especially the star density, that has an exponential drop, but it falls much more slowly than that. And so if you add this additional matter with that, roughly that distribution, you can actually get a distribution for the rotational velocity of the galaxy that is in agreement with the measurement. So this is if you add this dark matter contribution, this is what you get with Andromeda, for Andromeda, and this is what you get for this galaxy. So if you do this kind of exercise to match the observed rotational velocity of the galaxy for the Milky Way, you can infer that the density of the dark matter, and then this is some nice piece of information. You will see that the local dark matter density at the sun, it's in the range of 0.2 to 0.5 GeV per centimeter squared. It's actually not very well constrained, which is a number that's very important when you do direct dark matter searches. And you can get also information about the total mass of the galaxy. So while the mass of the stars plus the gas for a galaxy like the Milky Way is at the level of 1.4 times 10 to the 11 solar masses, the actual total mass that you require to get a good fit to the rotational curves, it's roughly an order of magnitude larger. So that's telling you that the mass, total mass of, or the luminous matter in the Milky Way is just roughly 10% of its total mass. So there are actually, this is a little bit of a parenthesis, better ways to measure the total mass of galaxies. And those rely on the motion of satellite galaxies. So the, both, if you just look at the local group, both the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxies have smaller galaxies that are gravitationally bound to them and orbit around them. So by looking at the motion of these galaxies and looking at their velocities, you can get, again, a determination of the total mass that is enclosed. And this satellite galaxy can be very far away from the larger galaxies that they're bound to. So they can give you mass determination to large radii. And if you do this exercise, looking at the satellites of the Milky Way and the satellites of the Andromeda galaxies, you get these mass determinations for these two spiral galaxies. And actually, the mass estimates in this case are dominated by the satellites that are farther away. And in this case, you're making the assumption that those satellites are actually gravitationally bound to the larger galaxy, which is not necessarily true. Those, you know, experts and people that study these things will tell you that, and at least in this case, this they were assumed in this kind of study. That's a very good assumption. One interesting thing is that if you just look at the luminous matter in Andromeda, because of things like density of galaxy clusters and other things, we'd expect Andromeda to be more massive than the Milky Way. But then when you include a dark matter halo, it looks like the Milky Way is actually more massive. Okay, so let's go back to clusters of galaxies. So you can learn a lot about dark matter by looking at clusters of galaxies. And now let's go back to the coma clusters with and look at it with the more tools than Zwicky had. So clusters of galaxies are very bright X-ray emitters, and they emit X-rays by very hot gas between the galaxies to this high temperature, and they emit through Bremsstrahlung. So you can measure by the mass, you can get a determination of the mass of the total mass of this object by looking at X-rays. Basically, that will give you some information about the gas pressure. And so that's going to give information about the total mass in them. But you can also look at optical images of these objects and get a mass determination. I mean, you can do it also with gravitational lensing, but in this case, for this study, this was done just looking at the virial theorem in a way that similar to what Zwicky had done. And you can get a good agreement. So this is determination of the mass looking at optical observation and looking at X-rays for a number of galaxy clusters. And you get for a large number of this cluster a consistent measurement of the total mass in this cluster with these two different ways of determining the mass. And what the picture that comes out of these measurements is the galaxy cluster mass is roughly 1 to 2%. Due to the stars in the galaxies, 5 to 15% due to the gas in the cluster, and the remaining is dark matter. So roughly here, you still have the mass of the cluster. It's dominated by dark matter, roughly the same degree that a spiral galaxy is.
What are the white and black dots?
It may be two different population of clusters, but I don't remember. Okay. Yes. Okay, so I think you're going to have lectures on gravitational lensing, so I'm going to go through this, I think, at the end of the... Okay, so I'll go through it. But I'm not, I don't have a lot of details, so I think that's okay. So gravitational lensing is another way to measure mass, and just very, it's a very, it's basically just the image distortion of some faraway object, which is caused by some intervening gravitational potential. And so this is a nice image of gravitational lensing. You see the stretched image due to the mass of this cluster. So, and gravitational lensing doesn't discriminate between baryonic and dark matter mass. It's sensitive to the total mass of the gravitational lens. So from general relativity, you can relate the deflection. So you have an observer here. This is your gravitational lens, and this is your faraway object. And so the deflection of this object, alpha, can be determined and through general relativity, and it's proportional to the mass of the lens and the impact parameter. So if in the in the approximation that the object that you are observing or the distance between the observer and the object, it's very large and much larger than the size of the lens, you can calculate the image separation and get this get the dependence on the mass of the lens and the various distances. And you see that this, what is called the Einstein radius, it's a quantity that is proportional to the square root of the mass of the lens. So by just when these conditions apply, you are just looking at the image separation that you observed in lensing, you can get a quick determination of the mass of the lens. It's just proportional to the square root. To the square root of m. So in the case where actually the object that is distorted is not in the line of sight with the lens and the observer, but it is at some angle, then you can relate the Einstein radius to actually the actual position of the objects and its image. And there are more than one solution. It can be more than one solution to this equation. And that means that you might see multiple images of the same object or stretched images for a more extended object. So we have different kind of lensing depending on the mass density of the lens. So for strong lensing, you have very strong effects. As I say, you can see multiple images or rings, and this is an example of strong lensing. However, for weak lensing, which happens when you have smaller mass densities, on a object by object basis, you really don't see such a strong effect, but you can actually see if you can look at the effect of the lens statistically by looking at a large number of objects. And so that you can see basically that in the image there is a trend that you can describe by some intervening very large mass density. So strong lensing, it's very helpful to trace the inner parts of the gravitational lens where the mass density is large, and weak lensing is very helpful to look at the outskirts of some gravitational lens where the lensing is weaker. Yes.
So naively, I would expect that if I'm seeing an object from behind a dark matter halo or something, mm-hmm. then I'll see images on all sides and it'll be circularly symmetric.
Right, but that if you have that object in the line of sight.
So if I don't see images on all sides, does mm-hmm. it mean the dark matter distribution is not spherically asymmetric?
It might mean that that object that is being lensed is not in the line of sight, right? And that is going to distort the image. Okay.
But even if it's slightly off-center, would I see this on all sides?
I think that this image is going to give you more of an idea. Right? So it's, and it basically comes down to this equation, to have different solutions.
Right. So for an object, even that is off-center, I see images, I see lensed images on both sides. So I should see it in every direction, right? So
that's good. Right.
They depend both on the brightness, right?
Like, yes.
R squared, you call it R squared, right? A distance can fall off the equivalent.
Right. And so you can see magnified in one direction, but then you, in the other direction, or in some other region, it's not, you're not going to see a bright enough effect. Right. The things are not going to be symmetric in this case. Okay. Micro lensing is an example of strong lensing where so this is say for gravitational lensing, if you have a large mass density in the lens and you are looking at a very large distances, like distances between very far objects of the order of gigaparsecs. And the gravitation in this, for this condition, gravitational lensing would give you image separations of the order of arc seconds, which actually you can observe. But if you're looking at galactic scales and where the mass of the lens is of the order of the mass of a star, and the distances are galactic distances of the order of kiloparsecs, the image separation is much smaller, and it might not be observable. But microlensing, it can actually still be observed, even if you don't actually can't resolve the image separation. You can have a case where you have the observer, you have a star, which is your lens, and you have a background star. As the that star comes behind the lens stars or near it in the line of sight, its brightness is magnified by the lens. And so what you see, it's the light coming from the source are becoming brighter. And this is one of the techniques that is used in detecting exoplanets, because the orbit of an exoplanet can actually cause a spike by contributing to the lens in the image of that source star. Okay, so this is just everything really I wanted to say about gravitational lensing. So gravitational lensing gives you information about the mass of the lens, and so it is used to determine the mass of things like clusters of galaxies. And in particular, one of the examples that is more popular is the example of the Bulle cluster. In this case, you're not just looking at one cluster, but you're looking at a collision between two clusters of galaxy. And this is an image, optical image of the Bulle clusters. And again, this is what you observe. So here now the color is showing you the distribution of the gas in the two clusters that have collided. And this is the actual distribution of the total mass of the clusters as traced by gravitational lensing. So what you see is that this distribution of the baryonic matter in the system is traced by the gas. So as we said, as I said before, the baryonic mass of a galaxy cluster is dominated by the gas, is offset from the distribution of most of the mass of the cluster as traced by gravitational lensing. So as the clusters collided, the gas in one cluster interacting with the gas in the cluster it was colliding with just basically slowed down, while most of the matter, dark matter, just went through for the two cluster without significantly slowing down, and the same was true for the galaxies. So this is, again, an image. This is, again, the bullet cluster. The colors here show the X-ray image telling you where the gas is located. And the contours here are contours that are determined from weak lensing. And here, the contours are gravitational lensing in blue, coming from strong lensing. So the image of the Buddha cluster in weak and strong lensing gives you a consistent picture of what most of the mass in these two clusters is. And and it is, again, offset from where the baryonic matter in the clusters is. So what that is telling you is that most of the matter in this system is collisionless and dark. Yes?
What is the time scale of the process?
Oh, it's probably, I don't know, millions of years?
So what we're seeing now is just this picture.
Oh, right. We haven't seen them moving. We are just taking a snapshot of what they look like now. Yes?
Is the center of mass of both variants that aren't the same?
The center of mass, so what do you mean of the...
So you can see the mass of the variant, you see the center of mass of the dark matter unit there. Are they at the same place?
Oh, you mean the galaxies? Right, you're not talking about the X-rays tells you what the most of the baryonic matter is, but the galaxies, actually yes, the center of mass or the centroid of the galaxies, it lines up with the centroid for most, the total mass of the galaxies, of the cluster. So that is not offset, and that is what allows you to set constraints on the interaction, cross-section of the dark matter. Galaxies, they're not, it's rare that in such a collision, galaxies are actually going to collide, so they will go through. If dark matter is collisionless, it will do the same. And so if that happens, the centroids of this distribution are going to be fully lined up, right? They're going to coincide with each other. If, on the other hand, dark matter has some sort of self-interaction, the dark matter will, the two dark matter halos are going to interact, and so you can see, you could observe an offset between the dark matter centroids and the centroids of the galaxies. And so the fact that this offset was not observed allowed to set constraints on this interaction cross-section. This number is pretty large compared to the size of the electroweak force, but it's weaker than the strong force. So I don't know if then there was some other measurement that claimed that those two centroids were offset.
Well, I mean, the size of the cluster is on the mass.
Right. Yes.
Something like the very large
cluster. Yes. That's true. Right. Okay. So since the bullet cluster, more of these cosmic colliders have been observed. This is an example. I think this is called the baby bullet. It looks very similar to the bullet cluster, but it's smaller. Then there are a couple more examples. This is a much older collision, and this is a more recent one. But more or less, you see the same picture that you see in the bullet cluster. You have the gas that slows down and the dark matter that goes through.
How do they know that they're looking at
collisions?
Well,
I think
how do they know that those two populations are the same?
Okay, I mean, in the case of the bullet cluster, things were more clear cut because you could see the shock fronts of the in the gas. Here, I don't know about this system, how they know exactly how, if they are related. I think, I can't remember, I read something, but they have, I think they have. Well, I don't know for this particular case, so I probably shouldn't comment. But I believe that they do some study in determining what is really the chance that the object that they are seeing here are actually the same. Say that this gas corresponds to this matter distribution and not something else. Okay, so there are some other objects, on the other hand, that are a little bit more complicated. This is the train wreck. And here again, you see the distribution of the gas again in red and the dark matter in blue. But it looks the sum of the dark matter stayed, so some part of the total mass of the clusters is peaking where the gas is peaking. So it looks like some of the dark matter is trailing behind. So some people said, well, maybe this is caused by self-interactions. Then there is another example here. This is, looks much more messy, but you have some cases. I think this is a collision. It's more than two clusters of galaxies. And you see in some cases that the gas is ahead of the dark matter. So, but these are complicated systems, and probably it's hard to tell what's going on. But as more of the system are found, we're going to understand them better and hopefully get better insight on dark matter. So also, galaxy clusters can be used to constrain the matter total mass matter density in the universe. So as I said, the gas mass and the total mass in the galaxy cluster can be measured by X-rays and lensing respectively. So if you assume, and so this is the fraction of the mass of the cluster in galaxy cluster that is attributed to gas. If you assume that the matter content, so that this fraction that you observe in galaxies, the fraction between baryonic matter and total matter in the cluster is representative of the whole universe, you can actually constrain the total matter density of the universe. And so that's done here, and that you get a value of roughly 0.3. And you're basically, yes, measuring this ratio where this is the sub C is the critical energy of the universe. And we'll see that this is a very good agreement with other precision measurement in cosmology. So one other piece of evidence for dark matter comes from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. You can measure the abundance of light nuclei like deuterium, helium, and lithium. And what you find is there is a lot more that you would expect from just solar processes. And what you expect, there is a larger abundance of these light elements that you'd expect to find if they were only produced in stars. So then what people postulated is that these light elements are actually produced primordially right after a short time after the Big Bang, when the temperature was low enough to allow for these light elements to form. And it would take much longer time scales to start forming heavier elements like carbon and so on. So you can use a Big Bang. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis is going to relate the primordial abundance of these elements to the density of baryons in the universe today. And this is shown by the color bands in these plots. So this is the abundance of these elements. This is for lithium, helium-3, and deuterium, and helium-4. And this is the baryon as a function of the baryon content. So another thing you can do is to actually measure the primordial abundance of these elements to look at faraway objects where you expect the abundance of these elements to trace actually what was present in the very early universe. And those measurements give you the boxes of these on these plots. So the intersection of the boxes with the prediction from Big Bang nucleosynthesis can be used to constrain the baryon content of the universe. And what you find by doing this is that the baryon content of the universe is just a few percent. And you see that the measurement of lithium, it's actually maybe a factor of two too small, but lithium can be destroyed, so that is maybe not much of an issue. But the bottom line is that most of the matter in the universe is non-baryonic. This is what comes from this. And this is also something that is in remarkable agreement with the CMB estimates of the baryon density. So I don't know how much longer I have, but okay. So I'm going to go through the CMB very quickly because you definitely have lectures on that. And so The CMB is the relic of a time in the early universe when matter and radiation decoupled. And it shows you, this is an image from Planck, it basically that shows you that the universe back then was very isotropic and homogeneous with very small fluctuations. And so the fluctuations that are observed when the universe was so young are actually, if you don't put the dark matter in the universe, were too small to generate the structure in the universe that we observe today. And this is shown in this plot. So this is basically this power spectrum of matter fluctuation observed. This is observation from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And the y-axis gives you a measurement of the clumpiness at different scales. So larger scales are to the left in this plot and smaller scales are to the right. So if you only have baryons in the universe, and you evolve it, you're not going to get the structure that you observe today, and not even to make objects like the galaxies that we actually observe. So this plot is the very well-known angular power spectrum of the CMB that is obtained from Planck. And so you can look at the temperature field as measured by say Planck, and decompose this temperature field into spherical harmonics, and the dots here are the measurement that you observe, and the matching the location and the heights of the peaks that you observe in the power spectrum constrains the parameter that you can, the parameters such as the baryon density, the mass density in the universe, as well as the vacuum density. So this plot here actually just illustrates by how much the power spectrum you would change if you varied these parameters. And this is in particular by changing what the changes that actually are, sorry, I can't see the scale of the changes, but you can get a pretty large effect by varying the density of baryons and matters in the universe. And with a very precise measurement of CMB experiments today, that you can actually constrain these parameters. It's the power spectrum. This is changing the baryon density omega b, and this is changing omega m. And it tells you by depending on how you match them, is how much you change them. You change the amplitudes.
So what are you
keeping fixed in? Yes, I don't know exactly how they are changed. I don't know if yes, in this case, what the value of the other parameters are. I actually have a reference to this paper. Okay, so we have seen that, so this plot here shows you the vacuum density and the matter density, and the constraints that we get here from the measure of the dark of the matter density of the universe that comes from clusters, from the CMB measurements, and I didn't talk about it, but also from the accelerating expansion of the universe that you get from supernovae, and they have very beautiful agreement. And here is actually the same region in this plot that is constrained by Planck measurements. So all these measurements are consistently telling us that we live in a universe that's mainly made out of dark energy, about 68%, at some fraction of dark matter, and a smaller contribution from baryonic matter. And this is where it looks like we have a nice understanding of the universe today. So dark matter in this paradigm is believed to be cold, meaning that it's not relativistic. And this is actually, the fact that dark matter is cold is consistent with observations. So if you look at, these are actually simulation or what you expect the cold dark matter distribution in the universe to be. This is a very large scale. This is at the scale of, galaxy size dark matter halo. And this prediction, actually, especially if you look at the large scales, are in very good agreement with observations. If dark matter was hot, meaning, like neutrinos or some other relativistic particle, that kind of dark matter would actually smooth out the structure too much and no longer agree with observation. You can have warped dark matter that is somewhere in between, say it's a particle that has a mass in the KV scale, so that's not completely ruled out. But that's also something that, in addition to affecting a Milky Way-sized dark matter halo, also affects large scale structures. So depending on how warm you make this dark matter and how big of a component to the dark matter that is, you might get into trouble because you can't predict the dark matter distribution that you actually observe. Another possibility is that dark matter is actually cold but self-interacting. And that is also going to affect how dark matter is distributed. And if you make dark matter self-interacting, and depending on the degree of self-interaction, you can actually get a large scale structure, even though dark matter is interacting, that is very similar to what you would get from collision-like dark matter. So in other words, self-interaction would not affect large scale very much, but would affect mostly the small scale. So this is the image of galaxy-sized dark matter halo in the case of collision-less cold dark matter. In this case, in the case of self-interacting dark matter, you can see that the cusp of the dark matter distribution is smoother if you have in this case, while you can retain most of the substructure that cold dark matter predicts. And so maybe here I'm going a little bit backwards, but in the cold dark matter scenario, this is what we expect a Milky Way sized dark matter halo to look like. Actually, when this video started, the distances were of the order of several hundred kiloparsecs. And so the dark matter halo extends far past the luminous matter in the galaxy. So say a Milky Way sized galaxy extends roughly 10 kiloparsecs or so. The dark matter halo extends far past that. And it also has a lot of substructure. It's predicted to have a lot of substructure. And the highest density of dark matter is predicted to be at the center of the dark matter halo, and the profile of that distribution is predicted to be very peaked. This is what cold dark matter simulation tell us. But how much of this prediction can we actually test with the data? So there are a number of things that we really can't measure very well. One of them is the slope that the dark matter profile has at the center of the halo, meaning how peaked the dark matter distribution is. And so this plot shows the density of dark matter is the multiplied by R, where R is the distance from the center of the dark matter halo as a function of the distance from the center of the dark matter halo. These are different, the different curves correspond to different slopes, and NFW and NINASTO is what you get in cold dark matter simulation. So even simulation themselves in the lambda CDM scenario may give you different slopes at the innermost part of the dark matter halo. And then you can have profiles that are more peak cuspy or less cuspy. And in many cases, measurement cannot distinguish. So for the Milky Way galaxy, we really don't know how cuspid the profile is. Measurement really don't tell you. You can look at other objects, and I have a slide, I think, next. You can look at smaller objects like dwarf spheroidal galaxies, and those galaxies actually seem, the measurements seem to be more consistent with core profile, where within some distance from the center, there is no peak, the distribution of dark matter is actually flat. But lambda CDM predicts that the distribution or the shape of the dark matter profile is the same at all scales, is NFW-like or peaked at the level of dwarf spheroidal galaxy, at the level of Milky Way-sized galaxy, and also the level of galaxy clusters. But there are some observations that actually disagree, and some of the objects that have been observed seem to have a flatter profile. Now I'm going to go into the halo shape, but let's talk about the substructure. And actually, if you look at the local cluster or the galaxy in the local cluster, like the Milky Way, they appear to have a lot less substructure than predicted from cold dark matter. So in any way, all these details of the distribution of dark matter are very important to direct dark matter, indirect dark matter detection, because they tell you what kind of signal you expect to observe. And in many cases, we really rely very heavily on simulations for those predictions. So in terms of the dark matter substructure, so all this clumpiness that cold dark matter predicts, we actually, for the Milky Way, we have observed them, at least we have observed some of the largest of this dark matter clump, because these are large enough to have baryonic matter in them. They could form stars, and so they are visible optically. You can actually see them. And the kinematic of the stars is similar, following many of the things that we have discussed before, allow you to infer that the motion of the stars in these dwarf spheroidal galaxies, you can infer the mass that they have. And they are very much dark matter dominated, a lot more in some cases than, say, the Milky Way. So in the case of some of the dwarf spheroidal galaxies, that mass to light ratio can be much larger than 10. And that's actually also an important thing, because the kinematic of the stars gives you a nice, clean determination of the dark matter distribution in these systems. And you don't rely as much on simulations to determine it. And that makes them very good targets for indirect searches. And I just have this quick slide for one dwarf spheroidal galaxy sculptor that you can actually use the measurement of the kinematic of the stars in this galaxy to measure the slope of the dark matter profile. So what these people have done is to look at different population of stars in this galaxy, metal rich and metal poor, and one of this population is more strongly distributed close to the center, while the other one is a little bit farther away. So, and they're basically tracing or measuring the mass enclosed at two different radii. And so you have two points, and you can then measure the slope of the mass profile. And so this is what is shown in these two pictures. And what you see is the determination of the mass content at some distance for these two different population of stars. And you see that the measurements are in better agreement with the dashed line that assume that the actual dark matter is not cuspy, but it's cored, meaning that the distribution of dark matter doesn't continue to increase toward the center, but it flattens out. Does that mean that cold dark matter is failing in this case? It's complicated, because you can have most of these simulation, cold dark matter simulation, are only contain dark matter. So they do not include the effect of baryons. So some people have proposed that in dwarf spheroidal galaxy, you can have a mechanism of supernova explosions. So supernova explodes, they release energy, and they change the gravitational potential at the center of the galaxy by pushing all this material out, and the dark matter is going to follow that, and then it's going to have, even if dark matter is cold, it's going to have a flatter profile that cold dark matter only simulation would have predicted. So baryonic feedback is actually also an issue that is very important. And that is what people believed happens at the size of dwarf spheroidal galaxy. But if you look at a bigger galaxy like the Milky Way, they actually believe that the effect of baryons actually, some people believe that the effect of baryons is actually goes the other way around. Instead of flattening the cusp, is actually going to make it even more peaked. Because of adiabatic contraction, and then they call it, they call that a contracted profile. Yes.
If the gravitational mass is that much higher than luminous mass, then why does baryonic feedback have such?
So what happens is that so dwarf spheroidals have some period of some star formation at the beginning, but they don't have those things happened in the past where there was more baryonic matter in them. So that effect may be important, especially towards the inner regions of the galaxy. But some people would disagree. They would say exactly that there isn't enough. Those processes are not energetic enough to actually smooth out that profile. But other people say the opposite. So I think am I running out of time? I have just a few more slides, and then I'm just going to go into the indirect detection tomorrow. I just wanted to bring up that there is another way. People have come up with different ways to look at the. So, as I said, the largest substructure or some of the largest substructure predicted by cold dark matter we can actually observe, but cold dark matter predicts a very large number of this subhalo. Can we infer indirectly their presence in some other way? And what people have done, they have looked at streams of stars. So say you have a globular cluster, sort of a dwarf spheroidal galaxy that it's orbiting some more massive galaxy. And so the stars in this smaller system might get tidally disrupted and leave a trail of stars behind. So these are star streams. And if those star streams are generated in a smooth halo, you might expect something like this. But if the halo in which those star streams are produced is very clumpy, they might actually be more lumpy and present some structural gaps. And so people have been looking at star streams, and this is a star streams in the Andromeda galaxy, and this is a star stream generated by these globular clusters. It's hard to tell from the picture, this is the star stream, but there seem to be some evidence of gaps that can be explained with substructure or dark matter substructures that is consistent with the prediction of cold dark matter simulations. Actually, I'm not going to discuss it here. People have also looked at lensing of very far away galaxies. I'm talking about redshift. I think one is at 0.2 and the other one is at 0.8. And by using gravitational lensing, they claim they have seen dark matter substructures in these systems, as well. Okay. So this is talking with. So far, I've talked about dark matter, but could things like objects made out of baryons, but with very low luminosity, explain the observation or make out for this additional mass that we expect, that we actually observe in a galaxy like the Milky Way? So things like low luminosity stars, planet, or small black holes. And there are actually constraints on some object. These are the constraints we get from micro lensing. And these are the constraints that we get from binary system. This is the constraint of how much of the dark matter halo could this object account. And this is as a function of the mass of this object. And you can see that these constraints are basically really very quickly closing the gap for this possibility. And there is a recent study that actually looked at a larger sample of binary stars that seems to have even closed this window. Binary stars is a binary star system, and they are gravitationally bound to each other. And if a perturber goes by, it might break their bound state. And so these are good objects to test whether there is there are a lot of low mass perturbers in the galaxy. And I only have a couple of slides on MOND, just to have a full, a little bit of a more complete picture. MOND is modified Newtonian dynamics. This is what some people have proposed is not very popular as an explanation of all the things that we have seen so far. But you can actually, MOND is very successful of explaining the rotational curves of galaxies without without the need of adding any additional mass. So all you need to do is to violate Newtonian dynamics in some range for very small accelerations. And in that case, so this is what you have. In that case, you see that what you get is you actually get flat rotation rotation curves, which is what you observe. And this is, for instance, the one galaxy. This is what you expect from regular Newtonian dynamics. And the red, the green curve, actually, it's the a fit to the data, which is shown by the blue point, that you would obtain with MOND. And the red curve is what you would obtain with dark matter. And MOND is very good at predicting all the structure that you see in this rotation curves. It does, MOND does well at galactic scales. However, it doesn't do very well when you at larger scales, like galaxy clusters, for instance.
Is the red just dark matter without baryonic matter? It looks like it's, the Newtonian does have the feature around 5.5.
Yes, well, the shape is not quite. Yes, the stars and the gas.
Better if you added them both.
Right, yes. No, probably yes. Yeah, I don't know what's included, but this is really dominating. And but then you can see that MOND really can trace the rotational curves, which also are traced by just the regular Newtonian dynamics. So, which is really not a surprise because MOND is really following the mass of baryons. But something like MOND cannot explain the bullet cluster, right? Because you still expect the total mass to trace the baryonic mass, but you clearly see an offset there. And the final thing that it's this relation, the Talley-Fisher relation, that's been known for a long time, that relates the baryonic mass in this galaxy on the side and the rotational velocity of a galaxy. This is done for many objects. And MOND can actually predict this behavior. This is has the dependence on the baryonic mass causes V square. MOND predicts it. Dark matter doesn't, but you can adjust it so that it does. However, people say, why would the dark matter determine Talley-Fisher relationship would agree with MOND? So, but that I think it's something that is it's an open question. But dark matter is really the one thing that can actually explain at all scales the observations. And so we all this observational evidence for dark matter tells us a lot of things. So tells us it makes up most of the dark of the matter in the universe and interacts very weakly, at least gravitationally, with ordinary matter. It's non-relativistic, it's neutral, it's stable, or at least very long-lived, but it doesn't tell us what it is. And then I'm going to get to that tomorrow. Thank you.